Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking season one, episode one, but we're talking the feedback, talking what you guys have to say. Aaron, I heard reports about a lot of emails coming in from Jakarta. Just a ton.
Gotta close the borders. Gotta close the borders. Take all your flour, all the flour in your house, burn it.
Or eat all, it. Feed it to the dog.
All raisin cookies, burn it. Not because we're worried about fungus, just burn them. Burn them. Yeah. Get all these raisin cookies out of your house before someone might accidentally eat them. My God, there are some freaks out there defending raisin oatmeal.
Oh, why?
Really?
That's
going
not
to
a
the
hill
mat.
To die on.
People threatening to send us to our post office box. Biohazard, which is what
it would cost three times what it would cost to send us chocolate chips. So I'm just saying.
I mean, like, you know, oatmeal cookies are fine. Why do you want to put stale grapes in them? Come on. Come on.
Very stale.
But yeah, we're monitoring the oatmeal raisin cookie situation in Jakarta. The other thing I'm monitoring is we are the number two podcast in TV and film.
Solid.
According to Chartable and the iTunes rankings, the only one ranked higher is the official podcast, which again contains both showrunners interviewed by the voice of Joel. So this is some pretty fucking rarefied air to be in. And we owe it all to you guys. If you guys weren't listening, especially people rating, reviewing, liking, sharing, we wouldn't be here. We are punching like way above our weight class. And you guys are quite the what do they call that in the military? Force multipliers.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. It's always nice to see. I also did a poll. I promised I'd do this. I asked the Bald Move community whether people have played part one and two, just part one, or if people are just watching. I also had a fourth option for people who weren't watching at all. I was astounded. 23% of the audience in the Bald Men, there's like over 1,200 responses. This is a highly representative sample. 23% of our fans have played both of the video games, part one and two. An additional 13% have played part one. So you've got over a third of the audience being familiar with the source material. 60% are just watching. Only 5% of the community indicated that they're out on the show altogether. I think this might be some of the highest. I don't know that we'd ever had that much, you know, penetration of people that are familiar with the source material. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I'm trying to think if 40% of the Game of Thrones audience had read all of the books or any of the books. Like,
oh,
that seems unlikely.
Mm hmm.
But, you know, when you're dealing with podcast folks, you're talking about the 1% of the 1% of the people who are, you know, crazy about the show. So
yeah.
I thought that was interesting statistics. Now, that's not going to change how we cover. We're still going to do show first. We are not going to be dealing with spoilers. If we do talk about spoilers or things from a video game, it will be safely ensconced at the end of the episode. In fact, there's one piece of feedback about The Last of Us Part Two that I'm going to break at the super spoiler part two version. That's at the very, very end of the spoiler, consideration. So
the spoiler section is already evolving. I don't like it.
It is.
It seems more dangerous.
And as we're going to find out, there's just limited antifungals that you can use to treat this thing. Hopefully it won't take over the whole podcast. I'm going to keep that from happening. If me and Jim have to hug each other with a live grenade, last man on earth style, to keep stop the spread, we'll do it. Shall we begin?
Yeah, let's do it.
If you want in on this year feedback podcast, it's TLOU, TLOU, skip to TLOU, my darling, at baldmove.com. Just TLOU at baldmove.com. Tyler P says, I've just finished listening to your preseason coverage, and one of the things you worried about is, will this find an audience due to others thinking it's just another zombie show? I really don't think this will be an issue since it really has been a while since zombies have been relevant. Sure, you got The Walking Dead just finishing up, but there are many people like myself who have not seen a single episode of The Walking Dead in over 4 years. Personally, I feel like the true height of the zombie fatigue was right in 2013, where ironically, The Last of Us as a video game rose up and shined bright despite people being over zombie media at the time. I personally feel that the quality of the story is so good that people, no matter their presence, will love it. Personally, I was very excited to hear HBO, along with all the incredible talent, was adapting this for people like my dad, who I know will love the story, but there's no way he was going to buy a PlayStation 4 just to experience it. All in all, The Last of Us, while being a zombie story, quote unquote, is more of a setting, and a true story is between the incredible characters with the infected serving as background. I think that's 100% accurate and right. Mm-hmm. It's still something I was worried about, but you know, when you see over 5 million people checked out the first episode, I'm like, okay, yeah, people are in the mood for a late winter zombie tale.
Yeah, has it been long enough that it's wrapped back around and people are now again interested in zombies?
Yeah, it's like, and that's the thing.
Even early Walking Dead, we were talking about that, how you know, this might be the height of it, like season 3-2 maybe.
Right, because it kind of culminated in like all this increased zombie stuff. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is about with genres is even when they're dead, they never really go away. I mean, when there's a really good
right,
Western.
Right, like zombie,
like the zombies themselves. You can't kill Westerns. Every once in a while, there'll be a really good high profile one that comes out and everybody talks about. Hollywood musicals, another dead genre. But every once in a while, you'll get a La La Land that catches people's imagination. So yeah, I think it's clear now that my worry was unfounded, but good news for all of us, at least The Last of Us. Eddie S, I'm going to start by saying the zombies look nasty as hell. Their mouths are just full of tentacle porn, but it's a cool switch from normal zombies. I'm sure when they get into the city, there'll be more intense moments, but I wanted to see some more gore from the zombies. I don't know how their new noodle mouths are going to work, but it doesn't seem as fun to see his teeth chomping down on people. I'm hoping we get to see some messed up stuff soon with the clickers on their way. Thanks for coming to the show. Endure and survive. A little Savage Starlight quote for you. What do you think about?
I think the bite comes before the tentacles. You know, I mean, they gotta penetrate the skin to get those tentacles in there. You can see the neighbors are bleeding pretty severely. So I think it's going to be a little bit of both. You know, they won't rip people's guts open and stuff like that, but you'll get some disgusting things in different ways, I think.
Yeah, I'm like, even if it's just like the Borg in First Contact, where it's like nanotubes that inject and you just start transforming, like that's creepy in its own way. And I also, man, I think that weird mouth parts are scary. Like, imagine, like, all if you right. see, like, a cricket, you know, they got, like, this almost, like, two hands just kind of going, you can't tell on a podcast, but I'm wiggling my hands in front of my mouth like a cricket. And those things just flinch the flesh off of stuff. Hmm. It's just like an assembly, like a deconstructor assembly line. And, like, that happening to a human neck while it's simultaneously injecting things into you, man, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can conceive of what it's like for a crazy person to bite a chunk of flesh off. I don't know what grandma coming at me with a mouthful of alfalfa sprouts and injecting them into me. Ah, it seems more horrifying.
Yeah. I don't expect it to be as gory and violent as a traditional zombie show, but probably there will be some of that. So,
yeah.
I'm looking forward
we'll
to
get
it.
We'll get the more of that later when we're talking speculating about the violence and the gore of the show. Meg says, what a ride episode one was. I said I wouldn't let my excitement get to me, but I checked my not broken watch and I'd already shed a tear just 4 minutes in. I love what happened at 4 minutes in. Was it just
oatmeal
how
cookies.
Faithful
oatmeal
it was?
Cookies.
Yeah. They tried to give that girl oatmeal. Yeah, it's disgusting. It's disgusting.
It's the terrible joke that lady made about three.
The real grooming menace are trying to get children young and indoctrinate them into the oatmeal raisin. I love the majority of it. The only thing that threw me off a little was the test Joel dynamic. As far as I recall, she was the one everyone in the QZ Underground feared, but it also seems to be flipped to Joel being the more feared one. Tess just seemed less authoritative, even jumping at a non-moving dead clicker on the wall. You got any thoughts on the who's the real power in the Boston QZ here?
I don't remember that the Tess was more feared. It's totally possible. But I don't know, because I did go back and listen to the official HBO podcast, and they were talking a little bit about this dynamic between them. And something that we kind of picked up on as well, and it's that Tess has kind of a way of speaking with Joel, a way of connecting with Joel that makes him almost an extension of her in some ways. And I think that's super interesting, especially as we get kind of out of Boston and see how that goes. I'm going to be looking for that. But I think Tess has a lot more power than you would expect based on Joel's apparent reputation in the community.
Yeah, and in the game, I never thought that they were like the top dogs, you sure. know, like for their their independent status, not being like mobbed up with people. They were, I mean, they're the bald move of the QZ, you know, they're punching above their weight, but they're not the most powerful of the underworld. But like, to me, it's like if you think in The Godfather, you know, you've got Vito Corleone and you got Luca Brasi. Which one is scarier?
I mean, Vito, obviously.
Right, because he's the one that's holding Luca Brasi. Mm-hmm. I mean, you might say something wrong or bump into him in the club and get gutted by Luca Brasi. Yeah. But like the most people are going to die by him is the one that the Godfather puts the finger on. Right. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's Tess. Like everyone knows that Joel is kind of her chained mad dog that she can let off the leash. But she's the one that can obviously pacify him and calm him down and focus him up. And she's also the one that can kind of uncork him. And I still think that makes her, you know, I felt very strong as she's the one that had the quote unquote pants. She's got the hand in the relationship.
Totally.
It also kind of reminded me in the not as extreme way, but like Naomi and Amos in The Expanse. Where like Amos just offloads his moral processing to someone that he trusts better. And Joel is like this kind of numbed individual. He kind of like does the same. And clearly, I don't think Joel is a, you know, psychopath like or what. It's not that Amos is a psychopath. He's a
sociopath.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I don't think Joel is a sociopath. He's just very damaged and traumatized. So that was my take on it, though. Mara's up next. She says, I came into the show knowing nothing of the video game and not having seen the trailer. I will usually give a new HBO show a chance, even if I have no knowledge of it. Obviously, I can't speak for all noobs, but I love this first episode. I no longer enjoy gory horror movies, so I had a bit of trepidation in the beginning, but I thought they did a good job of balancing tension and mayhem and not being too outlandish with the gore. All while getting us to care about the characters enough to have emotional reactions in a very short amount of time. I'm looking forward to the rest of the season and seeing the journey that Joel and Ellie go on, but I'm hoping there is a spoiler-free way you can speak to how much gore I can expect. For example, do you think it's going to be worse than The Walking Dead?
No, definitely not. I can't imagine. The Walking Dead basically had no limits on the gore it could do, even though it was on AMC, where presumably it'd have more restrictions than HBO. I think the most gore I ever saw in the video game was the 95 times I would die during a stealth sequence.
I was about to say
one of the fungal zombies would get me.
Yeah.
So obviously that's not going to happen in the show, right? Joel's not going to get eaten 46 times trying to get through a building, Groundhog Day style, Edge of Tomorrow style. So I wouldn't expect like a ton, but definitely, you know, there are other characters who can die. And I think when they die, it will probably be pretty gruesome. You'll probably see a lot of stuff like that mushroomed whoever it was down in the subway tunnels. In that first episode, there'll probably be a lot more stuff like that. And if you consider that gore, I guess that could be pretty disgusting. But I don't think there's too much. And I've heard Craig Mazin talk about this, too. He doesn't want there to be more gore than there really needs to be. He doesn't want to go what people might call full HBO. And just do gore for gore's sake. So I think it'll be fairly reserved considering the genre.
Yeah, and I want to echo your comments because I found a YouTube video that is like the 57 ways Joel can die in The Last of Us Part 1. And it was just a quick shot of every single one of those sequences where you die and then either a human or a zombie gets you. There's one or two that stick out in my mind involving some of the more elaborate fungal forms. But like the thing that's interesting is right before it's about to get like full on Game of Thrones or Walking Dead, the camera cuts to black.
Oh, okay.
So like even The Last of Us' sensibility is not just like mindless gore. I mean, you'll see people get horrifically injured. You'll see people in pain. You're not going to see. Again, I don't know, but I wouldn't suspect you're going to see people like ripped in half, their guts torn out, someone pinned to a glass screaming as 100 zombies are eating their backsides alive. Right. It wasn't that kind of game. It's horrifically violent, but it's not sensationalized like you see, you know, the trend nowadays when you look at Peacemaker, The Boys.
Right.
Well, what is just like maximized gonzo type of gore. And that's not. It's, I guess, dare I say, more realistic.
Yeah.
And yeah, it seems like Craig Mazin agrees with that aesthetic.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Gary V says, what the fuck was HBO thinking debuting this show the same week as the NFL postseason playoffs are going to start? I know the overlap between the gamers and genre TV and film fans and fans at NFL may not be that great, but it's something that only applies, and it's something that only applies to American audiences, but certainly it's not negligible. I thought HBO was a bit short-sighted last year, having the latter half of the first season of Hot D go against the beginning of the NFL season. Where this had never happened in Game of Thrones, but trying to compete for eyeballs when the NFL is in its most important time of the year seems a bit foolish. Episode 5 of T-Lou is set to compete against the Super Bowl, for crying out loud. Seems downright idiotic. It seems like it would not have been an issue to hold on to the show for just a few more weeks to avoid the scheduling conflict. As part of that overlap of NFL and genre television fan, I'm kind of bummed that immediate discussion reaction of half the season will be downplayed, as it'll be the following Monday that a great deal of fans will be watching the episodes. Well, certainly a bummer for me, because I didn't like having to leave the hometown, my adopted hometown's hotly contested playoff game at the beginning of the fourth quarter. That kind of sucked, but, you know, you do what you do for the number two spot on Chartable.
Sure.
I don't know what to think. I mean, obviously HBO got a lot of eyeballs, however they track it on Sunday night.
I've got an idea on what this might be.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a bit of a, like, what came first, because if you remember, not only did House of the Dragon premiere or air around the same time as the NFL stuff last season, but so did Rings of Power. And Amazon, through Amazon Prime, has the rights to stream the NFL stuff now.
The Thursday night games particularly, yeah.
Oh, just the Thursday night games?
I think it's just a Thursday night, but that's germane to this because that's when their other TV shows premiere.
Okay, well, but it's not germane. I was thinking they had rights to stream all the NFL stuff, so this might not matter. I was thinking maybe it's counter-programming, because if Amazon Prime has the rights to stream football games, you'd want to counter program your biggest shows against it, I would think, to try and steal their audience. So I don't know. I don't know. That blows my theory up.
Yeah, and there is increasingly, it used to be, you know, back when I was a teenager, there was a pretty big firewall between the jocks and the nerds that played video games. Sure. But that has slowly been breaking down as video games become more accepted. And you've got like Madden and FIFA kind of like paving the way to where I'm into sports, but I also like video games. And, you know, The Last of Us is one of the most well-selling and critically acclaimed video games of all time. So there is a lot of crossover there. But like, I don't know that HBO cares if people watch it Sunday night versus Monday. And like, you're also, this is a very East Coast. This is a very East Coast American perspective, because like Mountain Time and West Coast people are like, oh, cool, I just got done watching the last playoff game. It's 9:15. Time to start The Last of Us. So could they have gotten to 7 million if they didn't have, weren't competing against a playoff game? And the other thing is like, the playoff game has to be good. Like if that Baltimore Cincinnati game was like a 40-10 laugher at the fourth quarter, like you'd have a hell of a lot of people turning it off in favor. So I don't know. It is some competition for the first 4 or 5 weeks though.
Yeah.
Especially the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is the one where I could really see eyeballs being taken away from it. But again, the premiere night numbers are not as important as the like 1 day plus three, like to places like HBO Max and HBO. I think they're increasingly looking at like how many eyeballs are we getting in those first 4 days to judge. So, and it doesn't impact our coverage because we're just, or I guess I'm the one taking a hit because Jim is colorblind to sports.
Yeah. Not my thing.
Doesn't see that spectrum. Wesim from the UK says, I thought it all looked perfect and very faithful to the game. My only complaint is what happened to Mercy. You can do what you like to people, but I need to know that all the dogs are safe.
Well, the good thing is you get to make up your own story about Mercy.
I think Mercy is a good boy and he got away clean.
I mean, the you could also think, well, we jump forward 20 years, so Mercy's probably dead anyway.
But true. Like, That's old for Border Collie.
Yeah, but Mercy died in their bed, happy, peacefully.
Surrounded by their pups and loved ones and their pack. Yeah. They're holding their paws, candlelight. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Also, if you are a huge dog lover, play The Last of Us Part 2. That'll cure you that.
Okay.
Because dogs, if they're not on your side, are real fuckers. Real fuckers. It is so funny because this was the last Craig Mazin project. Like people watch firemen get melted in their boots, not bat an eye. See men ordered to their death by radiation. But one batch of dogs get shot because they're irradiated. And oh, my God. Oh, my God. The tears flew. Rob from NC, North Carolina, says, I'm curious to see if they address technology in the universe. It's clear that they're somehow generating power and either have been rationing very carefully or have a way to refine fuel for trucks, helicopters, and etc. They plan to drive from Boston to Cody. I have to assume that they're going to need gas along the way, so I'm interested in seeing how they handle that. Can you shed any light on this, or is it all mildly interesting?
It's not even mildly interesting. I don't know. I would assume we're going to see them with a big truckload of gas canisters provided by the Fireflies, but I don't know that.
Yeah, and there is some mild interest here. I think it's suffice to say that in the game, you in fits and starts get an idea of how 20 years on society is either trying to keep crumbling infrastructure going with less and less resources or trying to restart infrastructure that's been lost. But I think it's safe to assume that there is some limited amount of petroleum being extracted from the ground, being refined, you know, lots of solar, lots of batteries, lots of, you know, everything that's got is very limited and precious, especially things that are, but it's still, it's not like society, it's not like The Walking Dead where like all governments have just collapsed. I mean, Fedra is proof that there is some central organizing authority that is trying to maintain something. To some success.
The bigger question to me is how the hell anybody survived this, given the nature of the infected. How they can run and jump and climb and all kinds of shit. How do they not just storm the walls? But how do they get walls established in the first place? How do they get enough space between them and the infected to get a wall up around Boston?
There's a reason we don't have healthcare in this country. It's because we have the most fantastic killing people things that you can even imagine. So I imagine a wall of lead around some of the key cities might have gotten, and the Army Corps of Engineers might have got something together before everything just went to shit. But
makes me wonder how many cities are out there, because I don't know. There's a lot of people in America. It's tough to
I'll say that, like, even as a person who played the game, it's unclear to me how many safe zones there exist. Because so you play a character, Joel does. He's not plugged into shit. So
yeah, QZs of this size have to be pretty rare, I imagine.
I would think so. Garth says, in the Instant podcast, Aaron asked what the point of having the introduction take place in the 60s, what the point was. I think it serves a number of purposes. One, it gives a convenient way for an info dump without making it seem too ham-fisted. We've seen a plethora of shows and movies where they just force a newscaster or other character to give a huge amount of info in the midst of chaos or outbreak. I'm sure Druckmann and Mazin wanted to find a unique way of explaining the information that the audience would need later for the game. Two, it adds some heightened drama for our current society. How many scientific theories, which later turn out to be true, have been dismissed? Or even worse, just ignored because society was unwilling to change the current way of life or thinking to accept these. Mm-hmm. In this situation, the third point, Joel was born in 1967, and if my math is right, he would have been all of 1 year old at the time of the broadcast shown in the prologue. No one we meet in the pilot would have been much older, if alive at all, or able to change a damn thing if they watched the broadcast. This adds a layer of tragedy to the point mentioned above. It implies, in a decidedly grim way, that we are all destined to suffer, or perhaps even go extinct, for the previous generation's inactions.
Yeah, grim stuff. What I was trying to get at with the climate change stuff that we were talking about. But yeah, I really like also the way that Mazin thinks about these things when he's writing. He talked about this in pretty good detail here. He told the story about how he pitched this twice to Druckmann. He didn't like it the first time. They were going to go with some kind of ant cordyceps nature documentary kind of footage at the beginning of this, until the very end, like a couple of weeks before shooting wrapped. And they just were never satisfied with it and ended up subbing out this. But he was talking about how this gives you a very distinct feeling that the threat has always been out there. And like you said, we've been just kind of resting on our laurels, ignoring the problem or the potential problem, thinking, it won't ever be an issue. You know, it's not an issue right now. So, who cares?
Yeah. No, I think this makes a lot of sense, and especially giving the distance, you know, that this is kind of like, it's a lot of people point out in the feedback that I didn't have time to read because I got like twice as much feedback as I could, and it's just the first episode. Global cooling was actually something that the scientists were more worried about in the late 60s. Neil Armstrong's talk at the Cincinnati History Museum notwithstanding, that was a thing that they were worried about going in. And it actually does seem like the world was primed to kind of go into another ice age, a period of cooling. And we subverted that with our terraforming project.
Right. Well, that makes me feel better about global warming.
19th and 20th centuries. Well, you know, there's too much of a good thing.
Sure.
But yeah, I think those are all great points, and I appreciate your email, Garth. Cohen says, there were a few things I found a little weird or nonsensical. For example, Tommy getting separated by Joel. From Joel by two cars, he could have easily jumped over instead of having to fend off a runner.
There was a lot of fire there. I was specifically looking for that. Like, how did they actually get separated? And it was a couple of cars blocking an alleyway with fire kind of encompassing the entire area. So I believed it, but sure, if you didn't.
It's a little video gamey logic where you got a character who can jump twice their height and run super fast and climb sheer walls, but they get to a chain link fence and they just can't get over it. Right. Just can't climb the 6-foot chain link fence because that's the edge of the level and there's no more, you know? So I felt like it's a little video gamey logic, but you're right. I think they also made it to like these things wrecked right in front of an alley.
Yep.
So like,
and
you
do
know,
you want to climb?
You can't just walk or yeah.
Like two cars on fire that could blow up at any
explode
moment.
Explode at
leaking
any time,
fuel
yeah.
And yeah, not me, yeah. Not me.
Yeah. Yeah. We also know that Robert and Marlene's groups had just finished a firefight when Joel and Tess arrive, since Marlene and her lieutenant are standing in the hallway with their guns up. So how come Joel and Tess didn't hear a bit of the gunfire?
That extra framing, man. Thick walls. No, I'm kidding. But
I do think being underground and also like immediately after firefight can be anything from 30 seconds to 5-10 minutes.
True.
And you can cover a lot of ground underground and gunfire. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't think it was that weird. Also, Mr. Pillhead McDumbfuck just standing there not firing a single shot while Joel rushed and body slammed him. I think they should have had him kill Pillhead McDumbfuck the moment Ellie stabbed him in the leg instead of having a pause. But we did get the awesome flashback to present Joel moment, so I guess I can't complain. Overall, minor gripes. This is a great episode and I can't wait for the next one. I thought the same thing, but also maybe the guy is on, you know, Vicodin or OxyContin or hydrocodone.
Sure.
So he is a little slow. He's not expecting Joel to rush him and beat him to death. He's expecting, you know, cause it looks like when Ellie stabs him, his reaction is kind of like, what the fuck, man? More than like, oh, the jig is up.
Yeah.
I don't think
he was still trying to make a deal with Joel, right? For more drugs, more tickets, whatever. Yeah.
Like, this is a drug addict and his only connect is through Joel. Like, there's got to be a hesitation there. But, like, you know, like I said, I think you've made good arguments for the side of the argument. I think that the episode's good enough that, as you said, you can overlook a lot of that. And again, I've heard just from people who've seen the whole thing and professional reviewers like Alan Sepinwall that this was kind of the clunkier of the episodes because they did have the director change and there was some reshooting. And so if this is the roughest episode, we're in for a smooth ride ahead. Dave from the Outer Banks, North Carolina. What I loved about this episode was that we got to see what we rarely do in a zombie movie or show, the beginning of an outbreak. Seeing the mayhem in the streets with Joel, Tommy, and Sarah was so fun and riveting at the same time. The chaos, the unknown, the feeding frenzies on unsuspecting victims, helicopters, explosions, the military turning on civilians on the first night is so awesome, and as a zombie fan, it's something we rarely see. This brings me to one of the big flaws in the episode, the fact that we only get to see the downfall of civilization for less than half the episode. It's frustrating. Don't get me wrong, I love where the episode landed. I'm just interested in the new world and the adventure that's going to take place. I feel like we missed out on an incredible television and storytelling opportunity by not giving us at least one full episode of Outbreak.
Huh. I'm trying to calibrate on that statement that we rarely see it. I think you're right that we rarely see the macro picture. But there's almost always a sequence of scenes or episodes where we see them dealing with the outbreak, the initial outbreak. I think The Walking Dead is sort of an exception in that, and where we just skip kind of right over it.
Uh-huh.
We're just in it. I'm thinking of like the Black Summer show, I want to say. It's like older shit, like Dead Set. Fear the Walking Dead was very outbreak focused at the beginning.
But we even remember complaining the same thing because we thought the promise of that was we're going to see the fall. And we kind of saw the first night and then yada, yada, yada. Now we got safe zones. Now we got this. Now, yeah.
Yeah. So you're not wrong. Yeah, after thinking about it for a bit, it's like, okay, maybe we don't see that.
I have a hot take.
I like it, though. I like seeing the bits that we did get to see here. But, man, how do you show much more than this without...
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess it could have gone on a couple more episodes. But I'm just so excited to get to the stuff that I know is coming that I don't really want to spend a lot of time in that. But that's just me.
And my hot take is one of the reasons the zombie shows shy away from this is it's really hard to tell the story of the world falling to zombies, I just think it's fundamentally unbelievable. Like,
gotcha.
You know, we have like in the United States, we have like a million soldiers. We have like thousands of tanks, thousands of aircraft, all capable of dealing with death to tens of thousands of people. You could nuke regions. Now, I think Last of Us, with like the food contamination that might have taken a while to get going, and the fact that these are fast raid zombies. But even still, it's hard for me to understand that the entire, and I guess that's the other thing, is the military likely ravaged too, if their batch of flour got, their strategic flour supply got compromised. Their strategic Bisquick supply.
The country's Bisquick reserves were tainted.
Do you know that the Washington Monument's actually just a giant silo full of Bisquick? That's where the strategic Bisquick reserve. Yeah, it was going to be the plot for National Treasure 3.
Okay. How about the Lincoln Memorial? Is Lincoln full of Bisquick?
He's actually full of, and this is kind of scandalous, Canadian maple syrup.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh,
Jesus. He's like a giant Mrs. Butterworth made out of marble. You just tip the whole thing over. It runs out his nose. If you listen back to our Walking Dead coverage, I've talked about this a lot. Like, I just don't, especially Walking Dead shambling zombies. Mm-hmm. They always show like a single zombie going towards and biting a soldier, and they pull him back behind the lines, and that guy goes, I was like, come the fuck on. Like,
yeah. Especially something slow acting in its infection. Yeah. It's hard to believe. But the faster acting the infection is, which this is pretty
fast. 5 to 10 minutes, pretty quick.
5 to 15 minutes.
And it looks like
the zombies can move. You start to up the ante there. And I want to say, like,
spreading through the food supply, something you can't avoid entirely.
Yeah.
You know?
And maybe can't even detect. Yeah, that's rough. I will say, I don't count nukes as part of the arsenal. But then again, I'm not a ruthless asshole who would use them on innocent civilians if I
being overrun
like
by a raid zombie virus.
I mean, what, you're going to go nuke New York City because there are like 15,000 zombies in it and spreading?
Nah, 15,000, 3 million.
100,000?
3 million?
Like, how many people are you willing to kill because maybe we can't get this under control with traditional arsenal? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm nuking New York City at 3 million zombies.
Oh, Jesus.
Sorry. Sorry.
Oh, Jesus.
Sorry, Big Apple.
I'm not moving to New York anytime soon.
Me either.
And you're not getting your hands on
love
the football
to visit
anytime soon, so that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, it's like a giant trolley problem, right? Do you sacrifice the queen jewel of America's cities to save a nation of 360 million or do you? And then the other thing is
so
like
many other options.
Really? You have so many other options to pacify 3 million rage zombies in a city that's still got probably another 7, 8 million to infect.
Sure. We've got traditional bombs. We've got nerve gas. We could kill all of the people in New York in a lot of different ways. Don't have to use nukes.
Okay, so you're not opposed to killing the people in New York. You just want the architecture.
Right, right.
Neutron bomb New York City. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to have to rebuild an entire wall.
My mistake. I thought this was a humanitarian concern. All right. All right. Luke from Melbourne, regarding the bracelet that we had some questions over, says her fellow students twitching appears to be what's called myoclonus, a common sign of certain conditions affecting the central nervous system, likely indicating that this student has recently been infected with the new fungal disease.
All right.
See, I didn't get that. I thought that it was just like, you know, someone fidgeting, like, you know, like the way you bounce your knee or.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it could also be this. That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah. A continued notable other disease which causes myoclonus is, oh, good Lord, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, sometimes referred to as mad cow disease, which is used as a cause of the outbreak in the film Zombieland and has been used in the X-Files as well. It's known as a prion disease, and it's a result of abnormally folded proteins affecting normal proteins in the central nervous system. No available treatment, and the average prognosis of only 1 year after diagnosis. It's just another example of some scary shit out there. Yeah, prions are frightening. Your proteins just fold wrong and you're going to die, and there's no cure. There's nothing you can do once those proteins fold wrong. It's fucked up, right?
It is.
Leah H. says, I'm a microbiologist, and even though antifungals are not my particular area of expertise, I thought I'd write in with what I do know. As far as I understand, we only have two major case classes of antifungals. All the mini drugs you mentioned are part of these two classes, meaning that they are all more or less have the same two mechanisms. I don't think anyone has been able to come up with something new for quite a long while. The reason for this is that fungi have more in common with humans than, say, bacteria do. In fact, fungi are genetically closer to animals than they are to plants. We have lots of different antibiotics that will damage, for example, a bacterial cell wall inside the body while leaving human cells untouched, because bacterial cells are fundamentally very different from human. It's comparatively harder to find the same thing for fungi because there are fewer differences. Someone might write in and correct me, but that's my understanding. Well, appreciate that insight, Leah. And Spoofinger, who is an ICU nurse that occasionally helps treat patients with severe fungal infections, also built on this, said because they're more rare, these fungal infections, they often go undetected for longer after you become sick because your health team is running tests for more common problems, bacteria, virus, cancer, autoimmune conditions. Also, because fungi can go dormant as spores, it can be very difficult to fully stomp out a fungal infection once it starts. Even when not dormant, fungi have cell walls made of chitin, which is the same material insect exoskeletons and crustacean shells are made of. I'm sure that gives them a degree of extra protection against our immune system as well. If we were presented with a novel fungal pandemic, you could expect it to take longer to identify the microbe causing the infection, the treatment options to be fewer and more harsh on the patients, and that the infection would be very difficult to eradicate. Another listener wrote in that's mentioned a lot of common antifungals because they are kind of acting on the same mechanisms, and humans are very hard on your liver and your kidneys. So you have to, you know, balance the cure being worse than disease. So yeah, I guess that is pretty fucking scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hope they don't evolve a way around the 94.5 degree thing. That'd be bad.
Yeah. I hope we don't make that happen.
John says, I want to talk about that cat gut parasite that was brought up in your instant talk. It's called Taxoplasmosis gondii. What it does is it lessens the fear in mice and makes them attracted to the smell of cat piss instead of repulsed. Fun fact, about 40% of people have this too, but it's believed people get it mostly from undercooked meats. Studies have shown that what is believed to link this parasite with the dulling of fear, making those infected less risk averse. From the NIH.gov site. Similarly, T. gondii has been linked to behavioral changes in humans. Toxoplasma infection is classically associated with the frequency of schizophrenia, suicide attempts, or road rage. More recent study shows that toxoplasma infection's prevalence was a consistent positive indicator for entrepreneurial activity. Fear of failure would be less important in infected individuals who are more willing than others to start their own businesses. These elements shed interesting light on behaviors and their possible relationship with toxoplasmosis, which is generally considered benign in adults. You're knowing.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Mark Zuckerberg is definitely infected, right?
Or he could be a fungus. He could just be an elaborate fungal.
He could just be a fungus, yeah.
He's just an elaborate fungal colony that is mimicking the...
It's like the skin suit in Men in Black. Yeah.
So they can take us all over, take our minds all over with social media. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you're onto something.
No, I was going to say, I'm definitely infected, right? We started our own business.
Yeah, but by accident. I think we're cool because we didn't intend to do this. That we're just doing this for funsies, and then people started throwing cash at us. We're like, well, okay, true. I guess. And honestly, we're terrible at everything except for we say this all the time. We're terrible at everything except for actually speaking into these microphones and encoding them into MPEG layer 3 audio format. You know, everything else we kind of suck at. So.
And even I think stuff we're good at is debatable.
We're still pure bloods when it comes to the toxoplasmosis, okay. I think.
Good.
We still have about 30% more. This is kind of funny how the statistics work out. 30% more feedback, but unfortunately, it's behind the chitinous walls of the spore lore section. It's really hard to penetrate these walls, and not recommended if you haven't played The Last of Us Part 1. We also have one email about The Last of Us Part 2. It's going to be at the very end of the spoiler section. So this is where you want to hit eject if you are a show-only watcher. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to get in on the feedback, send that in to TLOU, T-L-O-U, at baldmove.com. That stands for The Last of Us. And we will be happy to consider it for next week. And don't forget, Sunday night, right around 10 p.m., we're going to be going live with our Instant Take and Instant Talk episodes. If you're a club member, you're welcome and encouraged to join and watch us live. Participate through the YouTube chat option. We'll get to as many as we can. And if you're not a club member, then enjoy the Instant Take that comes out a few hours after that is recorded. And we'll be back, of course, next Tuesday for a no-holds-barred complete breakdown take of the episode. So that's what we got in store. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And now on to the spoiler section. As is appropriate, we have a lot of spore, actual spore lore to talk about, because I was asking people, like, what is your concern with the move from spores to tendrils? I got some takers on this. Chris said, in 2013, when I first played The Last of Us, I was an aircraft painter and I had to use a respirator every day. One thing I noted even back was that Joel's glorious James Brolin-esque beard would essentially render his respirator useless and kill him immediately. Joel would have died a bloater's death right from the start from breathing in all the spores that his facial hair let in. The purpose of the respirator is to form a seal around the face to stop you from breathing what's outside. This requires daily shaving, but rather than mess with the character design, the writers just let it go. You can do stuff like this with video games, but I imagine a TV show is supposed to be more realistic. Just a thought. This is also the reason why you have the characteristic walrus and goatee looks on a lot of firemen, because breathing apparatus has to have that airtight seal around their face. It's a big bummer for me. I use respirators sometimes when I'm doing woodworking and things. I think I'm fine because these are big enough particles that I think my beard strains them out pretty effectively. I haven't noticed, like, I can definitely notice when I'm not wearing my mask, and when I put it on, I get immediate relief. But for microscopic spores, yeah, Joel would probably be fucked.
I seriously doubt this was a concern during the making of the TV show, though. Like,
yeah,
I don't think this was a realism thing. I think this was, they just wanted to change it for other reasons.
Yeah. And, you know, again, a lot of modern respirators have really nice big windows. It doesn't really block people's faces much, but it blocks them a little bit. And you're hiring these people to emote with their faces. I've also heard that you can cover your beard in Vaseline to get a good. So maybe see in the video game is Joel's got a big old tub of Vaseline in his back pocket.
Yep.
He whips that out, does a quick little circle, and then adheres it to his face.
Yeah, they can't really. It's harder to make razor blades than it is Vaseline. So Vaseline's like gold in The Last of Us.
It is. If you want a beard, a post-apocalyptic beard, you got to have the petroleum jelly to go with it.
I mean, in the post-apocalypse, you're telling me you're going to shave every day? Get out of here.
Yeah.
I don't shave every day, and I live in a modern society.
Also, I don't know if you have to be clean-shaven. Like, I know that if you have a beard like mine, it would definitely interfere, but because that's the other thing is, like, they I've heard the same thing about diving with a mask, that, like, if you have a mustache and you got a full face mask or full nose mask, that'll leak. I don't get leakage until I'm like 30, 40 foot under the water. Now that's like just getting started as a scuba diver, but, like, I don't know. I think there's, but again, with spores, you wouldn't want to fuck around. So, yeah. Kevin from Cincinnati, the Queen City, our adopted hometown. The only thing I can think of that would narratively change in a show because of lack of spores is in the game, they come across spores in a location where Joel has to put on the mask and Ellie comes to his side. He says something to the effect of, "How are you breathing this stuff?" To which she responds, "I told you I wasn't lying." Maybe they'll have another way that the show will prove that she's immune and make it clear like that in later episodes, but they may just stick with the fact that she has the bite scar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that was like, yeah. But
yeah, we'll see.
I think that's, yeah, it's like if that wasn't in the game, I don't know that you'd miss it. Because a healed bite scar is a pretty good. And then again, it's not.
It almost
a
made
human.
Joel look dumb in the game. Like, you idiot! You know she's immune. Why are you questioning why she can breathe this stuff? You know.
I think there's levels of certainty. Like, it's been 20 years sure. and you've never for seen sure. one. And the other thing is, it's not just a bite mark in the game. And it looks like in the show, too, that you can see the starting of the tendril spread that is just halted and scarred over.
Right.
So it's not like,
bite.
Yeah, it's not like some person just got pissed at her and bit her. It's a fungal bite. That implies that there is some teeth involved, too, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the stuff with the old lady implied that, too. They're bleeding, like, from bite marks. They're not just...
But I think those tendrils could, do that flesh flensing thing. I don't know.
I assume it's a bite to break the skin, and then the tendrils go in through there, but...
Aaron says, I mentioned in the instant talk that I thought the lack of spores in the show was going to present a problem, and here's my thoughts. The entire premise of the game is to deliver Ellie to the Fireflies in order to develop a cure in the form of a vaccine. So far, this appears to be mirrored in the show. Now, aside from the fact that there is no successful vaccine for a fungal infection, and I highly doubt that 20 years into an apocalypse is the ideal setting for developing the very first one known to mankind, there deserves to be some discussion around what developing an effective vaccine would actually solve. Would it cure runners, clickers, stalkers, or bloaters? Absolutely not. Would it help those individuals who are mercilessly attacked by the aforementioned infected? Unlikely, considered they're often portrayed as getting swarmed and or mauled in such a way that their wounds are definitely life-threatening, assuming they even survive. Would it cure those who somehow manage to get scratched or bitten by the infected, such as Ellie and Tess? Possibly, but the game demonstrates that these circumstances are exceedingly rare. The only practical widespread application for the vaccine would be the prevention of infection from exposure to spores. This matters because there's significant moral discussion around Joel's actions at the end of the game. The argument that he does what he does, or what he does dooms humanity, is a very flimsy one in my opinion, even considering the in-game presence of spores. But what about spores? Without spores being a thing? It's not even an argument. The successful development of a vaccine would largely be inconsequential, and the possibility of which simply isn't worth taking Ellie's life, especially without her consent.
I don't know that I agree with that. It's arguable. I disagree because I'm going to argue it.
Okay, argue it, because I think this is pretty persuasive, but I also have some things that I want to throw in there. What's your first take on this?
I mean, it's clear that we're not able to contain this. I don't know that we can fight back against it without some more protections, something else in our arsenal. Like, it obviously devastated the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
What has changed in 20 years that makes you think it wouldn't just happen again if we tried to go reclaim it? So I don't know. And if you look at this kid who wanders in, it's a kid. Like, how did this kid get away from whatever attacked him and escape in good enough health to walk all the way back to the QZ and only be put down after he's taken in and tested? I think there are a lot of cases where people would get bitten or infected somehow. I'm not even sure we know the full extent of how people get infected, but get infected and then escape. I think there are quite a few of them, as evidenced by this kid.
Yeah, I think that the food vector, that like if there's a case of like one part in a million spores to like flour could contaminate somebody. Like that would be so hard to screen for, and maybe something that like if you had the world's full brunt of science to bear against it, you'd be fine. But the fact that like maybe there's a big outbreak in Austin, Texas, and we lost big parts of Texas, but then everything's fine for a month or two, and then another outbreak happens because we don't have the technology to screen for these spores. And then like if that keeps happening and it continues like in the, you know, in the safe zones, like every once in a while you get a bad batch of this or that. But the other thing is, like you mentioned, that we don't know how the infection works. I don't think the tendrils exclusively refer those fairly short range things at the zombie's mouth. I'm guessing that they're getting, because like some of this is based on concept art that they decided to not go with and in favor of spores. But like the idea that these mushroom, this can send out this mycelium, which is this spider webby network through organic materials, hundreds of yards, sometimes miles. There's mushroom colonies that spread underground for miles, and that you could be in an area that you think is safe, and then like a 12-foot tendril comes out, just zaps you, and then uh-huh. you're done. I did look at some of the concept art where it implies that some of those things might happen, or there might be a highly mobile form that has like big tentacles on it that can have like a bigger area of effect. And the food contamination, though, is
food contamination is a huge one. I would say also, you know, we're dealing with one particular outbreak that has had devastating effects. Who's to say that another type of fungal infection wouldn't evolve and be an issue in the future, even if we manage to get this one under control? It's all about there's a war on, right?
Yeah.
With the fungus and humanity, and every bit of weaponry they can aim at that thing is just another avenue for survival. I think vaccines are incredibly important, and if you can develop one, it might not help people who get directly bitten and torn apart by these things, but there are cases where it will help people, and every person counts. So
yeah, if you get mechanically separated by a bloater, you're not gonna if imagine they develop an antifungal based on Ellie research that they could like just get a crop duster to spray a city. And it's just going to kill within 24 to 48 hours all active infections. And
Or Monsanto puts it into their future grain seeds or whatever.
So it's fungal proof. Or you've got if you do get bit by one of those tendrils, it's now just like getting stung by a jellyfish, and it's no longer a life threatening thing. It's just something that sucks. And within 5 to 10 years, all of these zombies will have died and eroded, even the ones you can't treat. And if you can just keep everybody, it's a spark of it's not a everything's going to go back to normal. It's a spark of hope.
Right.
So, we'll see. I like I said, this is the one. I will congratulate you, Aaron, for being the first person to kind of made me think. Yeah. Because without the food, if they don't have to do anything other than the mouth tendrils, I'm back to kind of how does this zombie thing spread as bad as it does? And also what will a vaccine do? But I'm hoping.
I think there's more.
They're smart people, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'm also an admitted Firefly apologist. The end of this game, I have very strong opinions on. I mean, obviously, everyone's supposed to, right?
Interesting.
But yeah, we can talk about that when we get to the end of the season.
Yeah. My second playthrough, I saved up a lot of flamethrower ammo for that final scene. Let's just say that.
I used it on everything and anything.
You want to follow the light? So Mike from Buffalo says, I've decided to try to replay the first game and try to follow along with the show on a weekly basis. I'm trying to guess how far I need to go in the game before each episode. This will be my third time playing through the original game and my second time playing the Left Behind expansion. Just like you, I hadn't played the expansion since the first time it came out. I just finished it and the first hour or so of the original game. So initially thinking they'll try to cram Ellie's backstory from the expansion into the first or second episode of the show, but I forgot that the expansion is actually set up as a flashback sequence placed in the middle of the original game during a period of time where Joel is sort of unavailable in the story. It's during the winter sequence, right?
Yeah, when he's injured.
Mm-hmm. It's a time of reflection for Ellie, and now I won't be surprised if they do the exact same thing in the show. I guess we'll know relatively soon. Yeah, I mean, they jammed it in there because that's a place where it fit in the game. If you did it in the hindsight of you can do anything you want, it might be better if they, my prediction is there's going to be an extended cold open where it talks. You'll see Ellie and how she got separated from her family and got found her new friend, and they both get, I think it'll be a series of extended cold opens, or I guess the second most likely is, Mike, I think you might got something going on here that they in the winter episode while Joe's delirious, but before she gets jumped by the hunters or whatever the hell they're called, that she starts kind of reminiscing about how she got here. That could work too.
Yeah, sure. I have faith they'll do it well.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's the spores thing, and how are they going to, Craig Mazin's a pretty smart guy. So is Bruckman. or Druckmann. Yeah. Okay. God, I have approximate knowledge of his last name, Neil Druckmann. They're both very clever guys, and I can't imagine that they would be like, oh, damn, we forgot that the spores are the reason you need a vac. Like, they're going to have to think that stuff through. Mm-hmm. Mary says, I want to get your opinion on something regarding The Last of Us. One thing my fiancé was annoyed at in the first episode is they changed part of Joel's storyline in terms of why he agreed to smuggle Ellie out. In the show, Joel wants a car battery that he wants to use to find his brother Tommy. In the game, however, he only agrees so he can get his guns back. Joel's not a good person at the start of the game, but slowly goes on a redemption arc as his relationship with Ellie progresses. My fiancé is concerned that this change is softening him up to viewers a little too much right off the bat and will lessen the impact of what's to come later in the series, the game. I've tried to do some research on this, but there really is an explanation of why they did this. I want to get your thoughts on why do you think they did this? Is it a necessary change? And how do you think it plays out in future episodes? Can I say that I never thought that Joel was a bad guy? Like, especially if you judge.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And like,
in
I feel
a hard
like
world, a really fucking hard world.
You know, like Mike says in Better Call Saul, like I've met honest crooks and I've met crooked cops and I've met this and that. And like, you know, you're on one side of the law or another, but it has nothing to do with your character. That just is your relationship with the law. And I feel like Joel is that. Like, I think Joel is a guy who keeps his word, who doesn't betray his friends, who is not any more brutal or ruthless than he needs to be. Probably doesn't want to be, but you have to be to thrive in this world. And he's got a very tribal sense of identity, which I think is part of every good zombie apocalypse, you know, how your world kind of shrinks. This softening him up, I don't necessarily buy that.
Yeah, it's a pretty accurate depiction of who I think Joel is. But if you want to say it changes the audience's perspective a bit, I could see it.
Yeah. And there's also flashes of that, like the fact that he doesn't want to stop and help people because, like, hey, I got a kid.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if him and Tommy didn't, you know, if he in a different world where he never had kids and he doesn't responsible, maybe he and Tommy stop and help those people out. But he's a very much, I'm going to take care of mine first, and especially in a crisis situation. So yeah, I didn't find it super inconsistent. But I can also see, you know, maybe if you thought that Joel was just like a real, like I said, John, is Han Solo a bad guy in A New Hope?
Because
I think that's what Joel's morality is.
He's not, but only because he does the right thing in the end, I guess. If he had just fucked off and left the rebellion to do their own thing, yeah. I think he's more of a bad guy for sure.
Sure. That's where the heart of gold comes from, you know?
Right. He threatens to not do the right thing, but in the end he does. Yeah.
Yeah. Because of who he is compels him.
Right. Yeah. And it's not about the money. It's not about that. It's just that's who he is.
Michael T says one of the most interesting parts of the T-Lu's take on zombies isn't just that the victims are still alive. It's that in the early stages, at least on some level, they are completely conscious of what's going on and helpless to stop themselves. I got chills explaining to my wife how in the game the cordyceps go into a sort of dormant state when no one's around, and as they pace around, you can hear them mumbling to themselves about how much they hurt, things like that. I really hope they touch on that in the show because to me, it's one of the creepier aspects of the infection. Yeah, sneaking around some infected and hearing them like talk about like have moments of lucidity where they kind of realize the full horror of their situation for a moment and is extreme. I remember there's a YouTube video when the game first came out where someone had extracted all the different things they say in their idle animations, and there's some fucked up shit.
Oh yeah.
All yeah. Right. It is. Cause that is the horror of it. You know, that's something that was kind of debated in The Walking Dead, like how much of people are still, but like in The Last of Us, it's pretty clear. You're still a for at least the first part of the infection, a living thinking human being that is being compelled against your will to do this crazy shit.
Yeah, it's wild.
So, and I get, I think Craig Mazin is the type of guy to lean into that. So I wouldn't, it wouldn't surprise me if we get to eavesdrop on a few and Ellie and Joel have a conversation about, like, how do you feel about killing these people? Is this, you know, right? I think I saw in the weeks ahead that there was an art, like, she's like, you know, have you ever killed these fungus people before? What's it feel like? So I think that we've got that ahead of us. I'd be disappointed if they don't touch on this at all.
Sure.
Tom says, to me, the game did a lot of its world building through little collectibles that you would interact with throughout the levels. For example, Savage Starlight, the collectible comic book that you can find laying on the ground and collect the episodes. These were usually in the form of notes or voice recordings that would provide background and location Ellie and Joel traveled through. One of these background stories that really stands out is the community that built up in the sewers that you travel with through with Sam and Henry. I remember playing through that mission and gradually finding more and more notes that provided clues on what exactly happened there. It all leads to a crescendo when you discover the grisly scene where the survivors made their last stand. I remember a sense of dread come over you when you realize that Joel and Ellie find themselves in a very similar situation, the exact same room, now surrounded by clickers. I feel like the show doesn't outright include these collectible stories. They should at least provide a little Easter eggs for the game players to piece together.
Yeah, the thing I love most about The Last of Us storytelling, and the reason I consider it kind of the absolute peak of that environmental kind of thing, is because it truly tells the story with the environment. I remember in those scenes, you walking around and seeing, like, you know, bunk bed barracks type stuff, and backpacks and water bottles and shit sitting on the ground. But then you walk into a room and it's set up like a classroom. Like,
yes.
Not with like a bunch of chairs and stuff, but like a chalkboard with toys and shit. And you're just like,
kids drawings.
I see what's happening here. I didn't even need to pick up those notes to know what had gone on here. And there's nobody there, so you can assume the worst in this world. It's the way they tell the story with just the environment is incredibly good.
Yeah, and I have a different opinion on some of these collectibles. I like doing the collectibles just for the completion aspect of it, just to, like, you know, to explore every bit of the level. I actually don't like this style of storytelling. And I think that, like, Horizon Event Zero Dawn?
Horizon
Event Zero, whatever the first one was.
You're getting caught up on Event Horizon.
Yeah. Horizon Zero Dawn. That a great story and a backstory, but it was exclusively told through these 4 and 5 minute holographic recordings. Mm-hmm. And as much as I like getting the story, I fucking hated having to feel like I had to sit there with Aloy and just to completely out of the game have this story force fed to me, and I couldn't do anything. Like, you know, I can walk around, but then I might miss part of the story, and I might get jumped by something.
Just don't give me, like, the freedom to walk around if you're going to tell me a story for 4 minutes, you know?
Right. And it's just like, I was doing this thing, sneaking around trying to avoid these robot dinosaurs, and now I'm doing this other thing, which is just being told a story through, like, an in-game cutscene. I don't really like that shit. And I really like the way The Last of Us did it, where that stuff was there for, like, I was, like, saving that stuff in the like Joel or Ellie's journal, and, like, at the end of the night when I was getting ready to get done with playthrough, I'd go flip through and read them. Okay. But you like that subway sequence, you didn't need any of that shit.
No,
because it, like you said, it told, like, oh, this is a survivor's camp, and oh, they had the military thing, and here's their radio up house. But, like, that school, when you get there, it's like everything changes about like the nature of this and what actually happened, and, you know, the gore and stuff that you find in connection with that. And I prefer that to where I kind of feel it's a failure of gameplay storytelling if you only get the story by going through those things. Like, a person just playing the game should know 95% of what a person reading the Skyrim lore books does, right?
And it can't be all exposition either. Imagine if you were watching a TV show that just did that, that just sat you down and had the main character just reading note after note and listening to audio recordings.
Right.
And, like,
right.
Oh, look, I know that's how Chernobyl opens, but it doesn't stay that way the entire time. But
yeah,
you gotta do something more engaging. And The Last of Us nailed it, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think that, like, TV has got a bet. Like, I can think of a million ways for Pedro and Bella to discover the nature of that underground facility and realize at the same time of the audience what's going on without having to pause and read someone's fucking diary.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. And now, back with more Bald Move. Shum says... It's got an incoming hot take. I expect there will be a lot of discussion debate around what delivers a better experience between the video game and the HBO series, but I want to contribute to a conversation with my bold contention. As much as I've been enjoying the HBO series so far, it's not actually possible for it to overtake the video game. My main argument for this is the video game forges a connection between you and the main character that makes the emotional beats hit harder in a way that cannot be replicated on a TV show. For example, the introduction sequence is a prime example of this. The game's opening cutscene shows the relationship between Joel and Sarah that gets you to like these characters almost immediately, something the show replicates beautifully. You again get to the first gameplay sequence where you get to actually play as Sarah as she explores the house looking for Joel. As the sequence progresses, Sarah gets more and more freaked out, and the player is able to relate to those feelings since we are expecting something scary to happen around each corner. We forge a strong bond with this character almost immediately. Joel returns with Tommy, kills one of the neighbors, and tells Sarah to get in the car. Sarah is obviously shocked by the sudden violence and feels completely helpless as she rides in the back of her car. Our bond with her grows even stronger as we have to strain to look out the windows and over Joel and Tommy's shoulder to see where we're going as the outside as we drive by. The player's movement is extremely limited here, and we can do nothing but watch the growing chaos around us as we enter the city. Of course, you know, car gets hit, Sarah gets injured, and the player's control now shifts to Joel as he's forced to carry Sarah. Because we have such a strong attachment to her, we really relate to Joel's fear and desperation to keep her safe. We want Joel to succeed in getting Sarah to safety, making the stakes very high as you run from the infected in this area. We get a moment of relief as the soldier kills the runner chasing us, and then growing horror as we realize the soldier's going to kill us next. So it goes on like this, and... he says that as Joel's desperate sobs, as he realizes there's nothing else he can do, are agonizing because his failure is our failure. We feel his loss as if it is our own. He says, I think the HBO job did an incredible job recreating the sequence, but our lack of agency as mere viewers put us at an inherent distance between us and the characters that cannot be overcome in this media. To be completely fair, the TV show can do some things that the video game can't, such as added additional depth and context to characters and situations the game doesn't have room for, but I just don't think there's enough to make up for the bond that's forged with the character that you can actually control and feel responsible for. What do you think of this hot take?
I don't think it's as hot as it seems. I mostly agree with this. I think this is why I get so frustrated with people, you know, like Roger Ebert, who say that video games can't be art. Not only that they aren't when they're on PlayStation 1, but they never can be, because
I mean,
you could do anything on a video game console that you could do on a television screen. You could just run a movie, call it a video game because it has a couple of in-game like prompts to make decisions or whatever. I mean, look at what Netflix is doing, right?
Yeah.
You can do that stuff and it will be every bit as effective as a movie. But what you can't do in a movie is put the player in the actual position of making those decisions, right? You cannot make a decision for a movie character or a TV show character. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. But you can in a video game. And that's entirely different. That is a new level of art, or possibility space, I guess, for making art. Now it's not, I'm watching someone else do this, how do I feel about it? It's, I'm doing this, how do I feel about it? I think that inherently forms a stronger bond with the character that you're inhabiting.
Maybe it's just because I'm, you know, kind of middle to older Gen X, but like I find a lot of I thought The Last of Us introduction works out really well. But I don't know how many times I just groan when like I'm in Call of Duty and my character has gotten injured and I have to crawl for for 2 minutes at a restricted crawling speed as bombs are ringing in my ears and I'm bleeding out and I can hear my own breathing. And I'm like, oh, so fucking immersive. Me holding this stick for 2 minutes as my guy stumble fucks for like kind of hate that shit when it breaks to just to have you do some kind of the Modern Warfare that had to press F to salute, like
to pay respects.
Stupid shit like that takes me out of the game. I don't remember many of those sequences in The Last of Us, but I think that they you know, it's like, to me, I'm either playing the game, I'm watching a story. And I find it very hard to blend those two together. Very few franchises do it successfully. I think God of War does it with the little quick time sequences, things like that. But like, it can definitely get to be too much for me.
Like anything, also, like film, it can be done very well and it can be done very poorly. Yeah. So,
and then this is not a new debate. Like, it's new because it's video games and all the video game adaptations so far have been horse shit. But like, what is the definitive version of The Lord of the Rings? Is it the trilogy of duologies that Professor Tolkien wrote? Is it the Peter Jackson version? Is it the theatrical release? Is it the extended release? Like, what is the definitive version? Is The Godfather better than Mario Puzo's original novel? And sometimes, like, it might be which one did you discover first? Because if you read the Tolkien books first and then you saw the movie, maybe you think the books are the definitive version. If you saw the movie and then read the books, I guarantee you're going to see Gandalf as Sir Ian McKellen. So I just think there's a lot of room to debate here, and I don't think there's a right or wrong answer.
Yeah, I mean, I'll agree with that. I think like you have to look at the possibilities. You can't look at the examples of how it's been done because it potentially could be done better. You know, if you were saying like in the PlayStation 1 era, well, these games just aren't immersive. Look how terrible they look. Look at the mechanics. You're just pressing this button to have to pay respects.
Right.
How could it be done? Right. Could it be done better? You have to think about what does the medium enable you to do? And in this case, it has something over film. Games have something over film in that they can actually put you in the position of making the choices for the character. And I think that is inherently a larger space to play in than being limited to something that is pre-scripted.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I can appreciate Shum's point here, because I think there is something to that inherent interactivity that makes you. But like, also, I think it's when I'm watching a movie about a parent losing a child, I'm not thinking, oh, it sucks to be that person. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I know how bad it would feel if I lost my child. And it kind of feels like it does feel like I'm sharing in their failure and their and their successes, you know, like that's why power fantasies work. Why I feel like the first time I saw The Matrix, I wanted to come out and do kung fu to the first guy I saw in a suit and sunglasses, because I was amped up by being, you know, like being Keanu Reeves, being Neo, being the one.
But at the end of this season, you're not going to get the choice whether or not to rescue Ellie. It's just going to happen in front of you.
Yeah.
Whereas in the game, you potentially could, right? So,
although, do you really? Because the part two starts and there's not a version where you can be like, what did you do? Yeah. Did you sacrifice Ellie or did you do this other thing? So there's
But ideally, you could. You could make that game. It's just way more expensive.
That's true.
And it's hard.
Yeah.
But as the art evolves, I think we will get there.
Okay, we're at the super spoiler part. Part two. This is going to be spoilers involving The Last of Us Part 2. So if you are the, 13% that's only played one, that hasn't played two, now's your chance to bail out now, because we're going to talk about events from spoiler from The Last of Us 2. Are you ready? Okay. Caleb says, how would you guys feel about Abby being introduced in the later parts of season one rather than waiting until season two? Or multiple flashbacks in the second game with Abby and her father set during the first game that would fit well with the narrative of the first season of the show, in my opinion. Plus, with her physical transformation she goes through after her father's death, it'd be interesting to see her before she gets completely jacked. The major change here, however, would be that we wouldn't start the second season hating her after she kills Joel, as we would be able to sympathize with her much quicker than playing the game. I think this could be a cool opportunity to have the show be a much different emotional experience than the game, but what do you guys think? I kind of hate this. What do you think about it?
I don't want to tinker too much with Last of Us 2.
Because you're right. It would have a very different emotional experience. But that emotional experience of The Last of Us 2 is unique. I've watched a lot of shit. I played a lot of video games, listened to a lot of music, read a lot of novels. I was very tempted to stop playing the game. Like when I got to the flip and I realized what I was going to have to do. I was going to have to play the rest of the game as this fucking piece of shit. I'm like, fuck, I don't want to do this. This is dumb. And I quit playing for it. And I think we did a whole podcast on this.
We did. Yeah.
That like, I begrudgingly like, okay, I guess. And by the end of that game, I would not have wanted to do it any other way. Because that's that's exactly the fucking point. Like how context matters to your view of someone's actions, good, and it does so much to explain so much fucked up shit in the world, both at the individual level and at the broader macro geopolitical level. And I would not want to do that. I want they definitely have to get the flashbacks in. You definitely have to see young Abby and her transformation and why she does the things she does. But I hope they find a way to where, like, ideally the first half of The Last of Us Part 2 would just be Joel and Ellie, you know, doing stuff and back together again, and they're strained, you don't know. And then at the, like, one-third mark, it just becomes the Abby show. And then, like, maybe you go away for that for, like, 10 episodes, and then the penultimate and finale, you bring Ellie back into it for the hammer.
As much as gamers don't want to see a switch in POV that drastic, I've never seen it done on television that way. It would be very ballsy. I'm kind of interested in them trying it, even if it's a colossal failure.
Yeah, and especially since it's part two and that they're not doing anymore, like, I'd just go for it, guys. Because I'm trying to think of, like, in House of the Dragon, if in the middle of the season, like, we just went away from the Targaryens or just the Alicent show.
Suddenly it's auto for 10 episodes.
Right. But you might feel different about, like, because, like, I felt like I had to, like, I was pounding spikes in my eyes trying to explain to people, like, you can, without changing your mind, see things through someone else's point of view. Actually help you defeat your enemies better and that kind of. But like people, I think that's one of the polarizing reactions to The Last of Us 2. This, you know, put aside all the, you know, culture wars bullshit. It, like I said, I don't have any of that baggage, but like Abby is a big fucking piece of shit. She killed one of my like a beloved character to me in a cold-blooded, ruthless fucking fashion. And like, I don't want to fucking know more about, I don't want to get in this person's skin. I don't want, but boy, I'm glad I did.
10 episodes of Laris. 10 yeah. episodes of Laris in House of the Dragon season 2. That's what I want.
All feet uh-huh. action all the time. So, uh-huh. so bringing Quentin Tarantino to guest direct those 3 episodes.
10.
One for each toe of Allison's feet. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is there such a thing as a toe open? A toe open? That's a new thing. That's ballsy.
QT would invent it. He'd have to invent it. I don't know. I'm curious for people to, you know, for the one third of us apparently who's done both, like, do you guys, you know, do you feel me? Because I prize The Last of Us 2 because it's gorgeous and I really like the stealth / aggro mechanic that Naughty Dog does so well. But I just truly appreciated the journey. And I prefer The Last of Us 2 over The Last of Us, even though The Last of Us has a maybe stronger, more straight through storyline, because I just never felt the things I felt at the end of The Last of Us 2.
I would say if you're looking for that podcast we recorded, it's in our off the clock podcast, which is a club only thing. So
yeah,
you search find for, it if you're not a club member.
Like if you do like search for Bald Move, Off the Clock, The Last of Us, you'll probably find it. And like I said, like it went to where I was flip flop, like where I was kind of sickened by Ellie's actions at the end of The Last of Us 2. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what agency you have, like whether you get a similar thing where you get the, but like
I don't think it's much.
Yeah,
I can't remember. It's been a while. I played that when it first came out. So,
but I definitely want to play that again before season 2. The other thing is like I don't think there's any confirmed season 2. Like
I think 4.7 million people watching the night of is almost a confirmed season 2. But sure,
because it's certainly Craig and Neil have been talking about it.
Yep, and they want to do it.
But I also think it's going to either be 2 seasons or it's going to be like one super 17 episode season. But who knows? They might, you know, they might have ways to condense all that. Anyway, that's going to be it for our spoiler, our super spoiler, the feedback episode. TLOU, The Last of Us. TLOU at baldmove.com is how you send us feedback for this show. Love to have you follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. If you haven't, please take an opportunity to rate and review our podcast in your favorite podcast app. Super easy. Just takes a couple seconds, couple minutes, and it makes a big, big impact for us here at Bald Move. And thanks for listening. We will see you again on Sunday night, either on the Instant Take if you're not a club member, or again, come on and watch live with us just after the episode's over. Get that link at baldmove.com if you're a classic club member, on patreon.com/baldmove if you're a Patreon club member. And come join us. Let us know what you thought. And if nothing else, we'll see you next for the full podcast on Tuesday. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.